From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Brass monkey, that funky monkey.
Brass monkey junkie, that funky monkey. Can white guys be hip? Can white girls be hip? I don't think too many.
Well, we've got Bill Evans, we've got Bob Dylan in 1965, 1966.
I don't see anything about either Bob Dylan or Quentin Tarantino that is hip in the way that, say, Miles Davis was hip. That's a different kind of thing. Brass monkey,
Castle, Brooklyn. Can white guys be hip? Today we'll explore the complex interplay between race and hipness, and along the way we'll touch on the lives of Miles Davis and Bob Dylan, even Bing Crosby, and the coolest hep cat you've never heard of, Chuck E. Wise.
I really don't make it a conscious effort to try to be cool, because it's lost its meaning. Cool was a counterculture word, and that now there is no counterculture. It's just like one big pop machine.
Brass monkey. So, can white guys be hip?
Absolutely. It's one of the worst misconceptions that hip should be partitioned into one category or another.
That's New York Times reporter John Leland, author of the book Hip: The History. He says hip can mean all kinds of things. But above all, the hipster is the outsider who crosses boundaries and challenges the mainstream.
Let's talk about hipsters. Who's hipper than, say, Miles Davis? And now, what was hip about Miles? Certainly Miles' style was hip, and Miles' voice was hip. But I think it begins with Miles' intelligence. There was a sort of conscious, intellectual quality to the way he played, the way he stood, the way he dressed. And within that, there was this tremendous knowledge of jazz lore, but also of classical music and also the broader world around him.
What about some of the other people? I mean, Louis Armstrong, would you think of him as hip, or Duke Ellington?
Ellington, you certainly would. And Armstrong, I think, is important to hip. You know, Armstrong was such a natural entertainer and had such an ingratiating personality that he would often bend over backwards to make people comfortable around him. And the truly hip often will not do that. I think that Ellington, just as flashy and as smart and as sharp and as streetwise as you can get, and a total hipster.
Almost all the people we've talked about so far are African Americans, and it makes you wonder. I know you say that a white guy can be hip, but so many times when you try to think of an example, it's a Miles Davis or a Duke Ellington that you think of.
Well, we could have as easily named Kerouac as the patron saint of hip, and there are to this day people walking around as little junior Kerouacs because he set such a glorious example.
Don't you think that Kerouac was maybe influenced by black culture?
Kerouac was overtly influenced by black culture, and he specified this in On the Road. He said, you know, he walked through the colored neighborhood in Denver wishing he were a black man, you know, wishing there would be more romance, more night, more excitement in his life. And so he very much understood hipness in that kind of cross-racial terms.
We really do have to talk about race then, don't we? I mean, in order to have any understanding of what it is to be hip.
I think of hip as a uniquely American phenomenon. I mean, it has grown around the world since then, but I think of it as forming in America and forming out of the unique interplay of black and white people, both newcomers meeting in this new land for the first time and having to invent identities for themselves as Americans in each other's presence.
You talk about Miles Davis again being hip. Everybody agrees. Jack Kerouac, okay. Who else? William Burroughs, maybe? Ginsberg, were they hip then, maybe not now?
Someone suggested to me that Ginsberg was a very nice guy, but if he was hip, then so was Lawrence Welk. I kind of disagreed with that. I thought the things that Burroughs and Ginsberg and Kerouac together. Remember, hip is a social relation. It's not an individual thing. You can't be hip in the same way that you can be tall or handsome. And I think that the group of future writers who gathered at Columbia College in the 1940s, which is Burroughs and Ginsberg and Kerouac and John Cleland Holmes, that is a little hip convergence.
You know, the other thing that all of those guys seem to have in common is that they were drug users. Is drugs part of being hip?
I think this is one of the troubling things about hip. Terry Southern once said that hip begins with a kind of supersensitivity that is so painful that one needs to anesthetize oneself from it, and that the hippest anyone had gotten was to be on the nod. And I think that's a very negative way of looking at hip. But I do think that that desire to know more than we are given by our teachers or our ministers or whoever will often coincide with drug use. So there are people who think that they will be hip if they use drugs like Charlie Parker or Chet Baker or Kurt Cobain. And I think that's a sort of a tragic mistake.
A lot of white musicians like Chet Baker and Jerry Mulligan and Bill Evans, they seem to take drugs because they thought they needed to?
Well, this wouldn't be true just of white musicians. It was true of black musicians, too. But Charlie Parker had thrown down the gauntlet. You know, jazz musicians wanted to be like Charlie Parker. And someone like a Frank Morgan or a Sonny Rollins or a Chet Baker, and Chet Baker was very specific about this, said that he wanted to have what Parker had, and the one thing he could do was put in his arm what Parker was putting into his arm. It was a way to face your fear. I mean, Frank Morgan, after he got off heroin, said he realized he never could compete with Parker on the horn, so he felt he could compete with him on the needle.
Wow.
You know, and it's a terrible story. You know, he was on stage at the California Club when the news came into the club that Parker had died of an overdose. And they called a break on the stand and shot up. Can you imagine that?
Then there's another side of it. Lenny Bruce is somebody you can't think of without thinking about drugs. He celebrated drugs. Was he hip?
Lenny Bruce was a guy who told the truth. And I think that that is a sort of classic hipster gesture, is to tell the truth.
I want the people, my friends, to dig is the lie. That you should say the words and be able to say the words in the streetcar if you do them. Respectability means under the covers. That's what it means.
There's another white artist who I think everybody would agree is hip, and that's Bob Dylan. Do you agree? Is Dylan hip?
I often think that Dylan is hipper now than ever. And I, you know, I pity the 18-year-old who wants to be hipper than the Bob Dylan of today. But yes, he was. He was sort of a gnomic personality. He seemed smarter than everyone around him, funnier than everyone around him, more daring and acerbic than all of his peers, and a mystery. And Dylan did play that racial line back and forth, back and forth. You think of the song Outlaw Blues, where he says, she's a brown-skinned woman, but I love her just the same. And that's a line that doesn't make sense from a white singer. It doesn't make sense unless the singer is African-American and talking about preference and skin tone.
I got a woman in Jackson. I ain't gonna say her name. She's a brown-skinned woman, but I love her just the same.
So that's a case of Dylan sort of crossing the line and playing both sides of it.
Dylan did that a lot, didn't he? I mean, he refused to be categorized. You'd think you understood exactly what he was going to do and that he was going to sing the same songs over and over again, and the next time he'd come out was the same voice but a whole different thing.
Well, from the very start, he was inventing himself, changing around things. When you thought you knew him, when you thought you knew who Robert Zimmerman was, he wasn't Robert Zimmerman. He was Bob Dylan. When you thought you knew the boy from Hibbing, he wasn't from Hibbing anymore. He was sort of an Okie who had spent his life hopping freight trains, or those are the stories he told about himself. And he continued to change every time we thought we caught up with him. Think of it as almost as playing on another court, and he was waiting for us to catch up with him.
What we have to do is deal with it when these individuals are young enough, if you will, to be saved.
Does Eminem fit into the history of hip?
Eminem, I think, you know, is a fascinating character for one thing. No one's been able to duplicate him. And I think that what's been so hip about Eminem is that as he's been performing in this, what's thought of as a black idiom, and acknowledging it as a black idiom, he has been very specific about his life. The minute you knew anything about Eminem, you knew what his girlfriend's name was, what his daughter's name was, who was the guy who beat him up when he was in fifth grade. He didn't try to create a persona, and he didn't try to create a black body of stories. He told this body of stories that was very specifically about himself. I like to share a story. This is my story, and can't nobody tell it for me. Do it well and for me. I'm well aware that I don't belong here. You made that perfectly clear. I get my ass kicked damn near everywhere. From Bel Air Shopping Center just for stopping in there. From the black side all the way to the white side. Okay, there's a bright side, a day that I might slide. You may call it a pass, I call it hauling my ass. Through that patch of grass over them railroad tracks. Oh, them railroad tracks, them old railroad tracks. Them good old.
That's Eminem with Yellow Brick Road. John Leland is a reporter for the New York Times. His book is called Hip, The History.
We heard a chick just the other day, cooling out her boyfriend in every way. She kept on a quarrel.
Bing Crosby, hipster? Well, these days it's hard to believe, but jazz critic Gary Giddens says the crooner was once just about the coolest cat around. Giddens is the author of a book called Bing Crosby, A Pocket Full of Dreams. Steve Paulson talked with him.
I have to start with the Artie Shaw quote. Bing Crosby was the first hip white person in the born in the U.S. What did he mean?
Well, first of all, I should say that I was doing a long interview with Artie, and you know, he said it in an expansive way, and it is sort of a joke. But what he meant was that Bing was the first singer who understood what swing was, what the black jazz musicians were doing, specifically what Louis Armstrong was doing, and was able to bring that into his music and into the public mainstream. He was right up there with Big Spiderbeck among the first white musicians who really understood what jazz was about and also brought their own individuality to it.
But you're also suggesting that one of Bing Crosby's great achievements was bringing together black and white musical styles.
No question. The thing about Crosby is he came up in a period, and this is true of Armstrong as well, when there was no such thing as hip versus square or in versus out or cool music versus nerdy music. It just didn't exist. The record player was new, and every record was a mystery until you played it. And Bing was extremely open to everything he heard. So in his early work, you can hear him working with the influences as varied as Al Jolson, whom he idolized, and John McCormick, the Irish tenor, and blues and jazz performers, and ultimately Armstrong. There are certain records where you can actually hear him do in an eight-bar phrase a little bit of a Jolson vibrato and then an Armstrong embellishment. So he really took all of this, and he played it all these strands into his own individual approach.
Oh, Miss Hannah, ain't you coming out tonight? The mockingbirds am singing, and the moon am shining bright. The roses am a-nodding and a-swaying in the breeze. Get on your Sunday, go to meeting clothes, and come along, please.
You know, for someone of my generation, it's hard to imagine that there was ever anything hip or even terribly new about Bing Crosby, but you write that he really revolutionized American popular song.
Oh, no question. I mean, everyone who heard him wanted to sing like him. And one of the reasons he so completely dominated the field in the 1930s from, say, 31 to 40, to 43, until Sinatra came along, Sinatra was his first real rival, is that all the guys who were influenced by him didn't start coming along until the middle, late 1930s. His contemporaries were still these rather effeminate crooning tenors, and they just sounded ridiculous. They had no sense of time at all. But by the mid-1940s, there's nothing but baritones. So everybody, and black and white, I mean, the great blues singer Jimmy Rushing, who worked with Count Basie, changed his style after he heard Crosby. Billy Eckstein was known as the Black Bing in his early years because he had that big, heavy bass baritone style. Whereas before Bing, the kind of singing you would hear outside of, you know, generic musics like blues or hillbilly, what have you, was typified by somebody like Gene Austin, and who would sing, you know, Joss Molly and me, in a kind of high, fluty voice. And Crosby comes along so virile and self-assured and cool and laid back and swinging, so that even when he sang mediocre material or just downright awful novelties, his timing and his phrasing was just always right on the button. And that's why jazz musicians admired him so much right through the 1940s.
You mentioned Bing Crosby's debt to the great jazz artist Louis Armstrong, and they recorded together in the mid-30s, and I'm guessing that there was not a whole lot of interaction between white and black musicians at that time.
No, that one of the things that most surprised me about Bing was his politics, which were not what I anticipated. He was so way ahead of the curve on civil rights. He was in favor of the legalization of marijuana. He was against the war in Vietnam. And as I'm learning all this, I'm thinking, what the hell kind of Republican conservative is this?
I always thought Bing Crosby was this guy who hung out at the country club
with
his golfing buddies.
He sure did that, and he had a lot of millionaire friends, and he liked to live that high sporting life.
Papa Bing, I've stopped by your place a time or two lately, and you aren't home either.
Well, I'm a busy man, Louis. I got a lot of big deals cooking. I was probably tied up at the studio.
You aren't tied up, you dog. You're just playing old gone fishing.
Babble, 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 babble.
There's a sign upon your door.
Pops, don't blabbing around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
Tell me about Crosby's collaboration with Louis Armstrong.
They first met in the fall of 1926 when Crosby had just joined the Whiteman Band.
And this is when Paul Whiteman really ruled the musical world.
He was a superstar by any definition you want to use. And he said, come on, we're going to go over to the Sunset Cafe and hear Louis Armstrong. And Crosby apparently had heard of Louis Armstrong. Certainly he had heard the records that Armstrong had made with Bessie Smith. But he had never seen him. And Armstrong was an absolute revelation to him, the spontaneity, the swing. And one thing that really floored him was the fact that here was a performer who could play a trumpet solo that would nearly bring you to tears, and the very next number do his parody as the Reverend Satchel Mouth and be hilariously funny. And Crosby had just come off a year in vaudeville in which he had been trying to mix music and comedy. And to see it at the level that Armstrong was doing it just really moved him, and he was immensely influenced by him. And in turn, Armstrong, as they became more friendly over the next few years, it was Crosby's success singing ballads that convinced Armstrong to cover a number of Crosby's hits, including Stardust, Wrap Your Troubles in Dreams, I Surrendered. Yeah, these were among Just a Gigolo, among the first standard tunes that Louis recorded. And then in 1936, after Crosby had fought for two solid years to get a clause into his Paramount contract, which would allow him to produce one film on his own outside the studio per year, they bought a short story and made a deal with Columbia Pictures to make Pennies from Heaven. And he said, now I'm in charge. We're going to bring Louis Armstrong out here. And the producer didn't want to go through the expense and didn't see the point. But Crosby did not negotiate these things when he wanted to do something. So they brought Armstrong out. And not only, even though he only sings one song in it, which a lot of people thought was the highlight of the film, and does two little dialogue scenes with Bing, Bing insisted that he be top billed as a star of the film, along with Crosby. And so this is what finally brought Armstrong out of the jazz world and into the mainstream. And this is when he really crossed over. So Bing did that.
Now every time it rains, pennies from heaven over. Don't you know each cloud contains pennies from heaven?
So when did Bing Crosby stop being cool?
When Sinatra came back, completely renewed in the mid-50s, Crosby knew his time was up because this was a whole different approach. Sinatra gave Crosby no competition in the 1940s. I know the myth is that everybody was debating who was better, but in terms of numbers and record sales, Crosby owned the era. But when Sinatra remade himself as Mr. Hipster and all that heavy swinging, in the 40s he'd been mostly a balladeer, he really represented something that had to do with the jet age and was completely in line with Camelot and the nuclear age and everything that was happening. And at the same time, rock and roll was completely dragging the kids away. So everything was rocking and swinging. It was very hard-edged. And Bing was just so cool and so laid back that he suddenly seemed like an old man. He seemed like your father. He basically recognized this and went into semi-retirement. So Bing just sort of, you know, faded away. And you know, when you go back, I can tell you, when I play for some of my skeptical colleagues and jazz musician friends some of his early records, and not just the jazz things, but things like Home on the Range or Brother Can You Spare a Dime, their jaws drop because these recordings are so powerful. So my feeling is that it may be now, to paraphrase what George Burns said about himself during his big comeback in the 70s, he said, "I'm so old, I'm new." I think it may be that Crosby at long last is so old that he's new enough for us to go back and rediscover him and say, this was one hell of a musician.
Louisiana, Louisiana, I've been sad, mighty sad. Louisiana, Louisiana, now I'm glad, boy, I'm glad. The whistle's blowing, the train is going, here I come, here I come. I'm tired of roaming, that's why I'm homing. Back to happiness and then some. Louisiana, no place is grander.
Gary Giddens is a longtime jazz critic. He spoke with Steve Paulson about his book, Bing Crosby, A Pocket Full of Dreams.
Take me to your heart, give me one more start. Eyes a little child, just been running wild. Louisiana.
Coming up, the story behind the website rentanegro.com and a legend of the LA Underground. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
This is Nick Hornby. Can white guys be hip? Well, I think that white people tend to be pretty uncool most of the time, but I don't think there's anything genetic that prevents white people from being hip. We've got Bill Evans, we've got Robert De Niro in the 1970s, and we've got Bob Dylan in 1965, 1966, and when you look at those photos now, it's really impossible to imagine anything hipper than that.
So, do black folks have a corner on cool? Or to put it another way, do white folks who hang out with black people have special cachet? Some secret X factor because they're hip enough to cross the racial divide? Well, that's a subject that really gets Damali Ayo going. She says her whole life she's had to play the role of professional black person, the object of curiosity for her white acquaintances. And she's sick of it. So she came up with a new idea. Why not charge for your services, just like a lawyer or a consultant? Become a black person for hire, a rental. Say that white woman's just dying to touch your hair, to feel the kinkiness? Well, sure, but that hair grab will cost her $100. Or your white boss invites you to his party, just to add some diversity. Okay, but he'll need to fork over $200 an hour to have you there. Damali Ayo is a performance artist who has written a book called How to Rent a Negro. She told Steve Paulson she has plenty of experience being the token black person. Just consider the hair grab.
Hair grabbing really starts at a young age and apparently continues on through people's late years. I mean, I've had 70-year-old people come up and grab my hair, much like I've had an 8-year-old come up and grab my hair.
They just grab your hair out of the blue?
Oh, yeah. There was actually an experience I had once where I was at a used bookstore and I was going through the checkout line and the cashier grabbed my hair and was squishing it and telling me how unique and strange it was and how she'd never seen anything like that. And I pulled my hair from her hand. And before I could even say, you know, you really ought not touch people so blatantly, she had picked it up again and was holding it and cooing and going on about it. So, yeah, it's actually a fairly common occurrence in my life. So, and that's why I talk about it in terms of a renting language, because in days of slavery, white people expected black people to serve their needs. In days of renting, white people expect black people to serve their needs. Very similar.
Now, you came out with a website a couple of years ago, rentanegro.com, and now you have the book, How to Rent a Negro. Well, a couple of questions about this. One, the word Negro is just about never used in polite company, certainly not by white people. Why did you use this word?
First of all, I think I would disagree with you that the word is not used by white people. I hear it more often than you might like to think.
Really?
Yeah, I've heard white people refer to me as colored. So, yeah, I don't know what's going on there. But I think given the permission, given the opportunity to use the word Negro, from what I can see, white people seize that opportunity, because since I've done the website and the book, people are using it around me a lot more in a way that for some reason they think it's funny, like, oh, you're the only Negro here. And I think, oh my God, have you lost your mind? You know, like I chose this title for the book because it's completely absurd.
What kind of response have you gotten from your website? Do you ever actually get someone who takes all this seriously and wants to rent a black person?
Sure, I have a bunch of those kind of applications from people who are saying, this is great, I've been looking for a service like this, to other people who are a little bit more timid, you know, saying, wow, I really, my bridge club doesn't think that I understand black people, and I really do. Can you come and help me prove it to them? So, yeah, absolutely.
Would you ever be tempted to go visit that bridge club and play that role or explode that role?
Yeah, you know, when I first drew up the site, my intention was to go out on these rentals and collect a little bit more income than I make as a conceptual artist.
So there really might be some money making here.
Well, that was actually the original intent, was that I was going to go out and make a living. You know, I've been doing this work for so long, I might as well make some money off of it. You know, but then it wasn't long before I got invitations to lynchings and gang rapes. And so I just realized I don't know who's hiding behind a seemingly legitimate rental application, and I wasn't interested in finding out.
Do you get asked certain kinds of questions too? I mean, as if you are the expert on the black race?
Of course. How do you wash your hair? Do you actually get tan? Maybe you get lighter in the sun. Oh, you love gospel music and soul food, don't you? Or can you teach me how to dance or make fried chicken? You know, pick the latest incident of crime that involved a black person, and white people will always ask me, how do you feel about that? You know, or what are people saying about that? Meaning, what are your people saying about that?
Now, can you give me some other scenarios that you've laid out? For instance, let's take the executive lunch. The white person, the business person who wants to be accompanied by a black person because it's going to look good. It's going to suggest more diversity or something like that. How might that scenario play out?
Mm-hmm. Well, this happens in offices, I'm sure, all around the country all the time, and it happened to me. A person in my office, in this case it was my boss, came in and said, hey, do you want to go out to lunch? Let me take you out to lunch. So we, you know, actually started to get into pretty nice tradition of going out to the Italian American Club where they had this fantastic calamari with spicy marinara sauce. And after about a year and I was leaving the job, my boss told me that he brought me to that place because he knew I would be the only black person there and it would really turn heads and shake things up.
Your boss told you that?
Yeah, we had a good relationship and I'm sure he thought it was funny. I mean, and that's what's interesting. I think a lot of white people are doing this stuff thinking that either they have the best of intentions or they're just, you know, it's just harmless fun. And the truth is it's not. It's absurd and it's degrading. And this book is here to say there's another way you can handle it.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's just play that out for a moment. Suppose that black people were compensated for this, as you're saying they should be. Let's take the executive lunch. You know, the person is brought along because it's going to look good. It's going to turn heads in the restaurant. Mm-hmm. How much should that rental get paid for that service?
Well, here's the what-if scenario played out. So if my boss comes in and says, hey, Damali, I want to take you out to the Italian club for lunch because I know it'll just be a hoot and everybody's going to stare at us because you'll be the only black person there. It'll be fun. Are you in? And so then what happens for me is I have a choice, right? Because I've been informed up front about what is going on. And so I have this great option to say yes or no. How wonderful is that? And that is an option that black people have been missing historically in this country. And then, you know, based on what I believe that service is worth, and I'm sure it would have to be appropriately priced, on geography and the demographics of the region, because in some regions that might be a more risky proposal than others, I could offer a price. And then this other person, again, has the choice to accept or decline. And then we can go into the lunch with expectations completely clear, with a wonderful contract, and we both get something out of it.
So that would be preferable. I mean, everyone lay their cards out on the table, be very upfront what each side wants, and then it's sort of a more honest situation.
Honesty is something I value so much. And I think that this is an important step to take. This might not be the most ideal way to handle diversity in our world, but it certainly is better than what we're doing.
Damali Ayo is a performance artist in Portland, Oregon. Her book, How to Rent a Negro, is a spin-off of her website, rentanegro.com. She spoke with Steve Paulson. Charles Monroe Kane is a producer here at To the Best of Our Knowledge. He's also an aspiring, cool, white guy. And he thought to himself, if he wanted to be cool, the first thing he had to do was to find out who's the coolest guy around. One name that kept popping up was the musician Tom Waits. But Charles took his search one step further. Who does Tom Waits consider the coolest? His answer led him to a legend of the L.A. underground scene.
Can white guys be cool? Many have tried and many have failed, but a few have done all right. Tom Waits, Hunter S. Thompson, Sam Shepard, maybe even Johnny Depp. But when it comes to the true cool, extremely cool, hep cat status cool, one name rises to the top as the standard bearer, the musician Chucky Wise.
Ooh, hi,
ooh, hi,
ooh, ba do ba do,
ooh, ba do ba do.
Oh, hi, eh.
Oh, hi,
eh. Ooba-doo-ba-doo.
Ooba-doo-ba-doo.
Pray to your Christ that you will all be saved.
I really don't make it a conscious effort to try to be cool. It's something that I've been labeled with. It goes along with, you know, having a persona of being like a hep cat or whatever. Mm-hmm. But it's such an overused word, you know. It's almost an embarrassment to have a label like that, because it's lost its meaning. It used to be a counterculture word. Cool was a counterculture word, and that now there is no counterculture. It's just like, you know, one big pop machine.
Everything about Chucky Wise reeks of a style long gone. He calls his music discombobulated, slip-slide-alicious tiki club jive. Folks just don't play the old slip slide much anymore. Chucky Wise learned this style as a teenager, playing with blues legend Lightnin' Hopkins. Not bad for a white Jewish kid from the burbs.
I was asked to by a club owner because he didn't show up with a band, and I knew his stuff, and I knew the musical stops, and the musical stops for Lightnin' Hopkins were very difficult because he'd stop anywhere he wanted. And I could feel the stops coming. So he liked that, and, you know, I played with him on the road off and on for years after that. So the issue of having a little white Jewish skinny kid, that's something that those guys like that didn't even think about race.
Chucky Wise also toured with the likes of Spencer Davis, Roger Miller, and Dr. John. And for years, he was the drummer for another blues legend, Willie Dixon. Here's a young Chucky in a duet with Willie Dixon in 1970.
Say, man.
What's that?
Who was that woman I saw you going down the street with the other day?
Say, man, that was no woman. That was my wife.
No kidding.
That's right.
Where was y'all going?
Just follow me and we'll walk on down the road.
All right, walk on down the road.
Race is going to be an issue if you're a white guy playing the blues. It just is. I mean, is he cool because he emulates the music and mannerism of black bluesmen? And so, how's that different from today's so-called hip-hop wiggas?
The reason that it becomes an embarrassment in this modern day is because I don't think any of those kids that are wiggas, I don't know if they have any idea the roots of where it came from or the roots of the music or anything like that. And I think that that's where it's kind of a lost and becomes an embarrassment. A lot of white guys tried to emulate slaves and act like them, and they started the minstrel shows, and then it became meshed with vaudeville. Now, putting on the blackface is no longer a part of that, but it's always been an aspect of American pop culture and music and comedy, too.
Shark skin Charles and watermelon head woke up this morning with weevils in their bed.
As Hazel climbs the stairs, cause she don't give a damn, I'm gonna eat all the mighty fine pudding that I can.
Do you know what lady I mean? I mean, do you know what lady I mean? Do you know what lady I mean? I mean, do you know what lady I mean?
Wow. If a white Jewish guy who grew up in the burbs can sing a song like that and pull it off, he's gotta be cool. Look, let's face it. If you want to be a hip white guy in America, you can't be afraid of race. You might even have to poke fun at black folks. And mean it.
Do you know what lady I mean? Do you know what lady I mean? I mean, do you know what lady I mean?
But it wasn't his days as a blues drummer that made Chucky Wise the patron saint of LA's hipster scene. It was his long-term residency at the seedy Tropicana Motel in Hollywood.
It was like a demilitarized zone of sorts. It was like somebody's worst nightmare of what a dormitory could end up being. Just a lot of different kind of people staying there, you know. And then if you lived there, it was like being on the road every night.
Right.
Because there was a new batch of characters coming in.
But you got like the Sam Shepherds and the Tom Waits and the Jim Morrisons and people like you there. Mm-hmm. That sounds cool as hell. You mm-hmm. think that can be reproduced today? Get all my buddies and move to the Tropicana. You think I can pull it off? Or is it a time gone?
The Tropicana is now a Ramada Inn. And so I think that's pretty par for the course.
Well, the dawn cracked hard just like a pool whip. Well, I wasn't taking no lip from the night before. And it shook out the streets as the stoop bums showed up like bounce checks, rubbing their necks in the sky to the color of Pepto-Bismol. Yeah, and the parking lots growled, my old sport coat full of promissory notes and a receipt from a late-night motel. The hawk had his whole family out there.
That's Tom Waits, singing some classic Chucky Wise lyrics they wrote together at Duke's Diner. Chucky went from Nighthawk to celebrity when Tropicana cohort Ricky Lee Jones wrote a song about him in 1979.
Don't you know Chucky's in love? Yeah, yeah.
It was a source of embarrassment for many years, but I'll tell you, before it became a hit, when it was just a girl I knew that was singing a song about me to me, then it was cool.
Right.
You know, and when it became a hit, it was still cool. But when I started to get publicity out of it, then it wasn't cool.
Chucky Wise may approach his music with the tact of a drunk at a wedding reception's open bar. But, you know, at least he's drinking bourbon on the rocks and not Red Bull or a flavored martini. He's a Raymond Chandler character. He's a true Nighthawk. He's a dying breed who doesn't even try. Chucky Wise just is. So, for all you aspiring Hepcats out there, here's some parting Svengali wisdom from the man.
Well, they got a very large bank account and a little small PP. And they're buying the Harley Davidsons and getting the tattoos and they're just trying too hard.
Now my father, he got too much wiggage, therefore he is gigless. And my sister, she's a punk in New York City. She's a junkie who is regular. If you wanna find me, it's not very hard to do. You just dial information, ask the operator for extremely cool. Extremely cool. Extremely cool.
Charles Monroe Kane is a producer at To the Best of Our Knowledge. You can find out more about the life and music of Chucky Wise at our website, www.ttbook.org.
Extremely cool.
Hip-hop is primarily an audio safari that allows white kids who would have in the 19th century dreamed about going to darkest Africa, they now can go to Tower Records, put down a $20 bill, and take an audio safari into the jungle of urban America.
Cultural critic Stanley Crouch, coming up. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
National support for To the Best of Our Knowledge is provided by Powell's Books, an independent bookseller since 1971, offering used and new books, collectible editions, staff recommendations, and unabridged reviews. On the web at powells.com.
This is Greil Marcus. Can white guys be hip? Can white girls be hip? I don't think too many. Certainly, some can. But being hip, being cool, what's involved there is reserve, is stepping back and looking at everything with an ironic eye, and doing that in a way that doesn't seem fake, that seems necessary, that seems this is the way you've got to live. Now, black people have had to live in the United States with great reserve, with care. They have had to watch their backs. That's the history of race relations in this country. White people haven't had to do that. And so when they adopt this sense of reserve, it often seems utterly contrived. That's why when you listen to Jack Kerouac read his poetry, Jack Kerouac, who we all know is just the coolest person who was ever born, according to the mythology of the Beat Generation, he's anything but cool. You can hear him trying to be cool, but boy, it just doesn't make it. You know, Bob Dylan was cool. Bob Dylan still is. Sean Connery was cool as James Bond. There are other people. Not too many.
Tell me, do you think I know
what is hip?
And if it's ridicule, let it show.
What is hip?
Tell me, yeah. Do you think I know
what is hip?
And if it's ridicule, let it show.
What is hip?
Tom Wolfe has called Stanley Crouch the jazz virtuoso of the American essay. It's a pretty good description, considering the way Crouch ranges across music and literature to racial politics. His latest book is called The Artificial White Man, Essays on Authenticity. Crouch told Steve Paulson that Americans have some pretty messed up ideas about what it means to be authentic.
We have sunk down into a situation in America in which we assume that all authenticity comes from the bottom, comes from the street. It's relatively absurd to see in popular media this constant definition of authenticity through something like the rap world, in which it's always a celebration of lowlifes and thugs and pimps and types of that sort.
Well, doesn't a lot of this go back to Norman Mailer's 1957 essay, The White Negro, when he celebrated black folks as outlaw figures because they were oppressed and because mainstream society wouldn't let them in?
But the fundamental question becomes, is the Negro actually an outsider, or is Negro American culture quintessentially American? I take the second position.
Because, you know, there are some people who would say that, I mean, those people who are obsessed with being cool or wanting to be cool or be hip, that's inextricably tied into being black. It sort of raises the question, can white guys be hip?
Well, I don't know about anybody asking that question, because it seems to me that for quite some time, a good number of black people have gotten their definitions of coolness, so-called, from white guys in films. For instance, James Cagney and Humphrey Bogart were very influential on black guys in the 30s and 40s who were street guys. Now, we know now that people like Michael Corleone and Tony Montana, these two fictional characters in The Godfather and in Scarface, have become cultural icons in the rap world. So there's always been an exchange in terms of what's cool, what's not cool, who's in, who's not in.
So the most famous example of a white cultural figure ripping off black culture is that there's that quote from Sam Phillips in 1953, you know, if I could get me a white boy with that black sound, I could make $1 million. And supposedly that explains why he went after Elvis. You're saying that's way too simplistic to assume that white people are always trying to find the underlying black coolness somewhere else.
Yeah, well, the first thing is that that's not really how culture works. Culture works on the basis of what people assume is good. I don't see why, if a white guy who comes from a background in Seattle hears Louis Armstrong on the radio playing the trumpet and wants to play like that, I don't see how that's ripping somebody off. That's acknowledging a monumental statement of great value. That's the way the United States works, is people trade back and forth. And I think that Elvis Presley would have sung the way he sang anyway, because he liked that particular sound that he had, that it was in the air. Or Benny Goodman is a Jewish-American guy whose family has roots in Russia, who grew up on the south side of Chicago, and who, if you listen to in his interviews on the radio in the 1930s, he sounded like a south side Negro. Now, he changed his accent later, and when you hear him on recordings, he absorbed that. That's what he grew up with. That was what he found that would allow him to express himself.
So you're saying there are real dangers to saying, okay, this is black culture, I don't know, let's say hip-hop, for instance, and something over here is white culture, I don't know, surfer dudes. Those are too simplistic, those kinds of racial divisions.
Oh, yeah, because the number one first thing is the whole hip-hop phenomenon for many years has been about appealing to suburban white kids. You know, I mean, hip-hop is primarily an audio safari that allows white kids who would have in the 19th century dreamed about getting on a boat and going to darkest Africa or India or someplace and going out and being among savage natives, that they now can go to Tower Records, put down a $20 bill, and take an audio safari into the jungle of urban America.
I've never heard that phrase before, audio safari. That's a good one.
Yeah, that's what it is. I mean, it's, these guys know what they're doing. It's just like, you know, Eminem, he was grown by Dr. Dre. 8 Mile is a Tarzan movie in which the natives end up submitting to the white guy, whose authenticity as a white guy from a trailer camp, right? White trash, so-called, makes him more authentic than a black guy from the middle class who's rapping. So it's a Tarzan movie.
Hmm. Now, we were talking earlier about what it takes to be hip or to be seen as hip. Is hipness something you care about? As a cultural critic, does this idea interest you?
Well, I mean, it's okay, but the first question is, from whence comes the definition? It's of absolutely no significance to me at all what some teenagers think about anything other than being a teenager. You know what I mean? I mean, some 16-year-old, I'm supposed to care what he thinks about world politics or the national religion or the budget or any. Be a kid.
What about older people? And I mean, I guess Quentin Tarantino would be seen as, you know, a quintessentially hip guy, or, you know, even older, Bob Dylan. Does that aura of hipness do anything for you?
No. See, I don't see anything about either Bob Dylan or Quentin Tarantino that is hip in the way that, say, when he actually was hip than Miles Davis was hip. That's a different kind of thing.
Explain that.
There's a quality of hipness in the dance routines that Fred Astaire did at his very best that haven't been exceeded by anybody of any color. There's something about the sheer ease with which Astaire does what he does. And I agree with Lincoln Kirsten that American virtuosity is about the fact that the very difficult is made to seem simple. And part of the essence of what we call cool is making something that's very hard to do seem easy. That's what the whole term cool comes from. He's not sweating enough to bring it off. She's not panning to do it. It's just something almost as easy as rolling out of bed. Now, of course, it isn't, but that's the illusion, and that's where the illuminated presence comes from in terms of those kind of people.
Is that partly what Miles Davis's mystique was all about, that he made everything look so easy?
Yeah, and he underplayed. There was a lot of subtlety in his playing. He wasn't a blaster. He helped to expand the identity of the trumpet to include a large number of subtle and romantic, even melancholy kinds of statements. Now, he could blast, though. He could blast, but that wasn't what he became famous for. Mm-hmm. That's why the women liked him. See, if you put an audience of women together, right, and there are three walnuts on a table, and one guy comes in there and he has a sledgehammer, and that's how he gets inside the walnut. Then the next guy, he comes in there and he has a nutcracker, and he gets inside the walnut like that. Then there's a third guy, and just by simply rubbing the walnut some kind of way, the walnut opens. He's the one they're going to be interested in.
That's great.
Stanley Crouch talking with Steve Paulson. Crouch's latest collection of essays is called The Artificial White Man. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. So what do you think? Can white guys be hip? You can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. If you'd like to buy a copy of this program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for the show, Can White Guys Be Hip? Number 821A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Charles Monroe Kane, Mary Lou Finnegan, Doug Gordon, Veronica Rickert, and Ann Strainchamps. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.